This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today on the show, history does not change, but our understanding of it does. And that can come from new discoveries or new methods of teaching, among other ways. Amanda Vivier is the spiritual director for Native American Christian Ministries. She went through a training program that helps people reconcile the tragic truths of oppression. She helped present the information detailing waves of colonization at NDSU in early April for American Indian Public Health Day. I spoke with Vivier about the presentation called Understanding Indigenous History and Colonization.
It was a very visual and the feedback circle afterwards, very emotional presentation. How are you teaching this?
We have blankets on the ground representing what the land looked like before colonizers came, before Europeans came. Throughout the exercise, we talk about the significant eras where colonizers came and took land, gave land back, tore families apart, sent kids to boarding schools. We also have on there where people died of right away famines, illnesses that our bodies weren't immune to. We had no immunity to it. It's a very emotional exercise. At the end, we kind of debrief and we talk about how it affected us. And through each group that I've done it with, it's always been very emotional. Sometimes you have some people's truths where it affects like the whole crowd, you know, and it's a very heart-wrenching memory for them. So you're able to feel their pain with them, right? To share that pain and to encourage that growth to come from it. I think that having this exercise and the participants being so true and raw with what's going on gives us a sense of hope for an understanding as a complete nation, right? So the oppressor and the oppressed, the Europeans and the non-Europeans. I find it really interesting when we sit and we do this presentation how there's so many other cultures who are able to relate to it. And a part of my heart goes out to that as well. And it makes me sit back and kind of try to dissect and understand why us Indigenous people are still so very affected by it, to where it's heart-wrenching on us more than these other people who've been colonized. And the only thing that I can come to is that the truth of it is still being suppressed. People don't want to come to reality of what United States really sits on. So in a sense, that's telling us that we are not still yet real people, because there hasn't been no true acknowledgement from the United States to the Indigenous population. In a sense, we're like invisible on our own lands.
I was surprised to see this in a panel put together on Public Health Day. I was expecting to walk into a discussion on diabetes or access to healthy food. Why do this presentation at a public health panel?
The reason my belief is, my truth is, in this, is that the disparity that's placed on us Indigenous people is because of the colonization that's happened to our people and continues to happen to our people. So it's like this big umbrella and all these things are falling under it. So the health disparities and the addictions and the diabetes and all those things also fall under that umbrella. This is kind of showing that here's where these things have started to begun, given a deeper understanding for the Indigenous population.
What was your first reaction? You said this is the third time you've done this presentation. What was your reaction the first time that you became aware of teaching the history in this method?
I cried a lot because it gave me such a more personalized, deeper understanding of why my brothers and my sisters are suffering, and that the hurt and the self not love in them is brought on by history and they're unaware of it. That made me cry, is they don't understand all the way back of why they're so hurt. it's like this. Some people, not all, so like there's those good handfuls and those bad handfuls, right? So some people have an understanding, but some of my brothers and my sisters are so lost in the historical trauma and the intergenerational trauma and the genocide that byproduct of it is so submerged on them that that's normalized, you know. So those things that are happening are normal. It's normal to be diabetic when you're 30. It's normal to pass away when you're 62 years old. You know what I mean? So those are things that are really heart-wrenching on me. And so I can share their pain that, and I share a deeper side because I have an understanding now that I've walked in that past briefly. So throughout the blanket exercise, I was kind of able to understand and feel like the squishiness of being on the blankets, of being crammed together. And then at a point to where we are ripped apart from each other, right? Feeling like you had no space, but you were so isolated because you didn't know the person right next to you. And that's that boarding school era. And then being taken away and put into your own little spot and then feeling even more isolated. At least you had the comfort of somebody before crammed next to you.
Do you hope that this program gets taught this way more widely?
Absolutely. I do hope that this program gets taught more widely. I think that it's something that would be very beneficial for a lot of the colleges, high schools, maybe even junior high is an appropriate age to also teach this in. As of right now, it's something that's kind of cycling through the ELCA, the Eastern Lutheran Church of America. But yes, I hope that it spreads through all universities. I hope that people can understand the vulnerability that Indigenous people still are in.
You're from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. Was this history taught to you growing up?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, the schooling that I receive in Belcourt is kind of like the bare minimum, right? So we are not shown as much things as non-reservation schools are shown. So I moved to Fargo when I was 9 years old. And so that move put me back even more grades than I already was. So I went back like 2 grades. But back in Belcourt, I was doing great versus coming to Fargo, and now I'm behind.
You said that you are a spiritual leader, and you've mentioned the ELCA a couple of times. What is the ELCA's role?
Spreading that word, helping the healing.
After the exercise, there was a feedback circle where people gave their emotional response to the exercise, and a number of times people brought up their struggle with Catholicism, because in the exercise there was a great deal of focus on early Catholicism until, honestly, not that long ago, the boarding school era, which it's not that far removed in our past, as one of horrendous abuse, neglect, murder, and yet a strong faith and belief system among the oppressed, and that difficulty in reconciling a faith that they feel today versus the actions of bad actors and bad policy in the past. How do you reconcile that within your own background?
So I'm a Christian. Or I like to say I'm a follower of Christ. So my belief is in Jesus Christ and the things that he has taught, and not in a religion. So I don't always agree with the church, but I always agree with Jesus Christ. So I don't know how that answer is, but that is my truth. The way I was able to cope, deal, and heal with that history is that they were false believers in Jesus Christ. And so that those were the colonizers, that came to steal, destroy, and kill. You know, Jesus talks about it in the Bible, is that we have an enemy like that. And he also talks in the Bible about how there's false preachers, false pastors, there's false people like that. There's always that wolf in sheep's clothing. That's kind of how I see that. False Christians, false believers.
Really struck by something that you said in your own portion of the feedback circle. You said, "I am genocide," and you were talking about all of the cultural legacy that you have inherited. And then you sort of said that within the context of, that was me until I started to learn my own language. Please correct me if I'm oversimplifying. What did you mean by that?
So I feel like if we can label things and call them for what they are in truths, that it'll bring healing and an understanding, and there's no more stigma on it. You can remove the stigma and put truth there. I am genocide. I am historical, and I am intergenerational trauma, because as we were talking about in the presentation, that there's this handful of students who had bad experiences in boarding schools, and then there's these other students who had good experiences. So if we break it down like this, the way that I see it, and I can view things from my life experience, is that, so we're going to say there's 10 people, and out of those 10 people, 3 of them had good experiences as an indigenous person. So they still know their knowledge, they still speak their language, they still have a lot of ceremonies, and first and foremost, they had that connection to the Creator, right? That spirituality, that culture. And then there's those of us who are like myself, who I grew up in a home of abuse, I grew up in a home of addiction, and my mother did, and her mother did, and her mother did. So there's this brokenness. I am a recovering addict, a recovering everything. You know, if I'm going to break it down, I'm recovering from being colonized, slowly but surely trying to pull away those pieces off of me to get down into the center of my heart and see who I am. Not to always revert back to the Bible, but this is where my healing began, was through Jesus Christ. I cried out to him, and so he had pity on me, and he healed me, and he led me to who I was as an indigenous person. And he showed me that what had happened in the past was that humanness, you know, that greed that did that, but not Christ. And one of the things that really struck me as I was beginning to wake up from my slumber is that God said in the Bible that he would take you out of the wilderness and take you back to your natural lands. And so that's really prominent with me. It's in the Old Testament. And it's really prominent with me because I get to watch my children not be a part of genocide. I get to watch my children not be a part of intergenerational or historical trauma, but to put that foundation under their feet by the grace of God, and to give them their culture back, something that I was never able to have because of the things that my mom endured. A lot of historical and intergenerational trauma. We are the byproducts of genocide, because with the life I was living, I was killing myself, and I would have probably died at a super early age and allowed my kids to follow that same road and die as well. And we didn't know. We were blind, right? So that was normalized to live that way. So whenever I hear people talk about, that's a choice, or that's not that long ago, well, here's the thing. We are still in active genocide. It's not, it's right here. It's right now. It's not that it's in the past. We're still trying to work through it. It's the way I see genocide is first, let's kill them off. Let's do this. Let's do what we can, you know, mass things like that. And then after you've caused so much destruction into a person and so much hurt and keep oppressing the truth, well, then it's, look what they're doing to themselves. They're killing themselves. And that's still genocide.
Another reaction that came up in the feedback circle was a woman who said that she often gets this pushback from people when she is speaking her truth and her experience as an indigenous woman, and that of her father who was abused in a boarding school situation. And people say, get over it. How do you react to that?
I have a dear friend who cried to me and is 64 years old. And I asked to share this story with others, and he was okay with it. So I'm sharing it by by being allowed to. With all this genocide that he was involved in, he experienced the rape. He experienced the abuse in boarding school, in a Catholic boarding school. So, and he's 64. So how much of a past is that? You know, and then not only is he the one who experienced that and had to carry that sickness throughout his life, not wanting to speak of it until now, that sickness passed down. So like that's intergenerational trauma. That's historical trauma mixed in with genocide. There is no getting over it until we heal. And there is no that's back in the day, because that's today.
The exercise ends with some of the blankets being unfolded a little bit. Nowhere near the original portrait of what the land was before colonization, but a little bit. How do you feel about the future?
Well, the realist in me says this. My people are awakening. They will no longer be in slumber, but their spirit will lead them. And if Creator God is willing, we will develop a system and a way to buy back land, to revitalize that traditional and cultural knowledge, to help nourish and care for a key for Mother Earth. If and when those opportunities arise to where allies awaken with us as well, to have that understanding and do a buyback or a sell back at a decent amount of money, that would be a true blessing, right? Mm-hmm. So,
one person in the feedback circle asked the question, what is my contribution? Who do you want to ask of themselves that question?
Everybody, right? But especially those who are awake. And I don't really like to try to be calling people out, because some people, there's this thing called entitlement, right? And sometimes people have this entitlement so much that they become so offended. And how do we approach things or use words in such an eloquent way to where nobody's disturbed? I guess I'm just going to have to be really truthful. My personal opinion would be that I would hope that the people who own land, when the time comes to where Indigenous people are ready to start doing buybacks, to revitalize it, to allow that to happen, or to take partnership in that, even, you know, to revitalizing things and bringing culture and spirituality and natural traditional knowledge, like for Mother Earth, to bring that back. And it's to be kind to that person that you see is suffering, right? And how could you give back? Or what would you take from it? I don't know. It's vast. I think it differs with each personal individual. So,
the 2018 midterms saw a record number of Indigenous people running for office, and there were several who were elected locally. We have Ruth Buffalo, Peggy Flanagan, the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Minnesota. How are you feeling after the 2018 midterms?
Amazing. I really admire those women for picking up their medicine and their strength and moving forward in that way, and for also being confident and strong enough to walk with true integrity of their culture and to be that voice and start causing those waves, to be that first rock to fall in the water, right? So now it's a ripple effect, and we're getting more protection, more of an understanding, awareness, a voice. Right, just that person who's willing to be vulnerable enough to be exposed to criticism, but yet still be strong enough to heal and move forward in such a good way.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Yep, thank you.
That was Amanda Vivier of Native American Christian Ministries. Up next on Main Street, a little wine to help us get through this spring blizzard and flood. And was there a tornado warning in there somewhere? Who knows what this weather is up to?
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The term fake news is so ubiquitous that sometimes it seems like we should be labeling the true stuff instead of the lies. Why do we believe obvious falsities, and how do these alternative facts gain such momentum? On our next episode, we'll find out. So join me and my guests Kaylin O'Connor and James Owen Weatherall for How Does Misinformation Spread? On the next Why Radio, Sunday, 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. With weather like this, sometimes there's no getting around curling up with a glass of wine. In this week's Plains Folk essay, Tom Easern introduces us to a winemaker he met on his recent travels to New Zealand.
The investigation of grape growing and winemaking in central Otago, New Zealand, has been one of the sweetest ventures in our lives as agricultural historians. The enterprise is based on hard work, to be sure, but there are amenities. There is a brand image involved. When we came to interview Rudy Bauer, a guru of the industry at his winery, Quartz Reef, the place did not fit the image. The sense is industrial, even at the cellar door open to the public. Rudy and his youthful staff and a stray dog come and go, unconcerned about appearances. We visited Quartz Reef Winery the day after we talked with Jackie and Murray McMillan at Mount Piza Station. That had been a memorable conversation full of meaning, not only for their country, but also for our own, the Great Plains of North America. The Murrays of Mount Piza mourned the loss of their rural community that had been inundated by a hydroelectric project. At the same time, the disruption had produced economic opportunities and brought entrepreneurial newcomers to the land. Rapid change had left the remainder of the agricultural population disoriented, wondering if the sense of community was hopelessly lost. All this resonated with our known experience on the American prairies. Then we talked with one of the great change agents of the new order, the vintner Rudy Bauer, and got a glimpse of the emergence in progress. Rudy is an Austrian immigrant, trained in viticulture and enology, who first visited central Otago on a bicycle tour in 1985. That was the same year the New Zealand wine industry took off, as English folk suddenly woke to the aromatic virtues of Sauvignon Blanc. Rudy's subsequent life was to be intertwined with the New World Wine Movement. And he personally would root himself, along with thousands of vines, in central Otago. A sheep farmer named John Perriam was one of the neighbors of the McMillans displaced by rising lake waters. He took his settlement and bought a sheep station, Bendigo, across the Clutha River from his old home. A complicated series of personal adventures brought Rudy back to the region to work at a developing winery. And in 1991, he took an interest in a particular terrace of land he espied at Bendigo. Along with John Perriam, as well as another partner with connections to the champagne industry in France, Rudy founded Quartz Reef Vineyard. With grapes from the vineyard at Bendigo, he makes both popular sparkling wines and fine Pinot Noirs. Although he confesses to resorting to glyphosate to knock out the weeds at first planting of his vineyard, Rudy, lithe and tanned, is now a visionary devoted to the practice of biodynamic viticulture and to, as he says, thinking like a grapevine. We talked at length about the gritty details of grape growing over tea in a workroom. Then Rudy opened a bottle of his best, and we resorted to casual, freewheeling conversation, which led to some remarkable observations. The winemaker is committed to fine vintage, but it turns out he also is self-conscious and reflective about the changes in the land and its people. How will a new community emerge from the gaudy diversity of people repopulating the region, people who see one another as others? He finds the answer in his kids. and in the common schools. Children of capitalists, laborers, farmers, technicians, people of every class and color are thrown together by the common interests and activities of their children. So as I reflect back on our interview with Rudy and on the situation of public schools in my own country, I take one more lesson from the land.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, Sue Belcom prepares an Easter feast. But now it's time for the news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. The House has approved a bill that was originally proposed as a way to get hunters and landowners to the table to work out their differences. But only a part of that bill passed. That's because the House divided the bill into two sections. As originally introduced, the bill would have set up an electronic database for private land to tell hunters whether it was open or closed. Right now, state law says a landowner has to post no hunting signs or the land is open. But sections dealing with electronic posting, as well as the creation of a land access committee to make recommendations to the 2021 legislature, were defeated. Opponents of the remaining measure worry that, in its present form, it would end hunting rights. But Ledgerwood Republican Representative Kathy Scrow told the House it would lead to conversations between landowners and sportsmen. She said passing the bill, as it is, could lead to further work in a conference committee.
It's been said this can's been kicked down the road and kicked down. And what my landowners are telling me in my district is that we're going to take that can, we're going to fill it full of cement and put a no trespass and no hunting sign on it and lock this land up so tight that no one will have access. I hope that's not the case.
The bill passed 55-38. It now goes back to the Senate. The 2017 Ag Census is out. And for the first time in 5 years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture gives us a glimpse into large-scale changes in the agriculture industry. As Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck reports, the census shows that farmers are getting even older, and there's more farmland consolidation.
The average age of farmers inched up again this census compared to 2012. It's now about 57 years old, and most farm operators have been at it for a while, an average of 21 years. There are about 70,000 fewer farms than there were in 2012. That said, the U.S. has more farms that are 10 acres or smaller, and more farms with 2,000 acres or more. The millions of data points in the census will affect government funding and programs going forward. It'll also likely affect agribusiness decisions and rural development around the country. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in Fargo. And in Bismarck, we have
Sue Belcom. She joins us once a week to talk about food for our installment of Main Street Eats. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. This is my favorite thing to talk about, food.
Well, it's holiday food too, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's even better, don't you think?
Yes.
And it is April. And you know what happens in... Oh, no, wait. It's April and Easter is really late this year for
it
some
is,
reason.
Yeah.
And somebody asked me why and how they determine when Easter is. And I know it has something to do with the full moon and the vernal equinox, but I couldn't pin that down for sure. So we're just going to go right into some Easter traditions from the Germans from Russia, which, as you know, is my family heritage.
And there are lots of holidays that lead up to Easter. I mean, special days, if you will.
Correct. And one that I either just wasn't aware of or my mother never, ever celebrated this, was called Shrove Tuesday. And in German, I'm going to try to say this, Faschnacht, Kichla, yes, is what they served. And what it was the day before Ash Wednesday, which, as you know, people spend 40 days of fasting or giving something up or making some kind of sacrifice to prepare for the celebration of Easter. And on Shrove Tuesday was the day that you indulged right. in something that had lots of sugar and lots of fat in it. And so they actually had special recipes like Shrove Tuesday donuts or Shrove Tuesday pancakes.
Yeah, I call it Pancake Tuesday.
Pancake Tuesday, there you go.
Of course, that's pretty much any Tuesday.
I could go for that. I love pancakes. Mm-hmm. I love it. But that kind of was how they kicked off the celebration. And then they did kind of strange things like not eat meat on Fridays during the season of Lent. And I remember eating a lot of fish sticks and tomato soup at school because we had, you know, we did have mixed population back then, you know, Protestant and Catholic going to the same school.
That same was, for me.
Yep. That was okay. So
such
we,
diversity.
Right, right. There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. I went to a very diverse school. And you know what? I talked about Coogan a couple weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago or whenever it was in March sometime. And now that I made wedding Coogan, which is the Catholic stuff, and I still know how to make the Protestant stuff, then I am now bilingual Coogan baker. So yay for me. Okay.
So how do you make the donuts and pancakes special for Shrove Tuesday?
Oh, I think you just put a lot of powdered sugar on them. One of the things that they called them Schlitz Kichla, which they were folded up in a special way, you know, and deep fat fried, but they were milk and cream and baking powder and the whole nine yards. So that was your like last big whoop-de-doo before you got into the season of Lent, and then you had to like deny yourself things. So,
well, back in the day, of course, we had Easter egg hunts that were actual eggs. Now people typically buy some chocolate thing, but let's talk about making old-fashioned Easter eggs.
Well, think about it now. They didn't have commercial Easter egg dyeing kits, so I have found that the process of dyeing back then, they used things they had around the house, like vegetables. Now, think about this. Beets or grapes or coffee or tea, that stains your teeth and your clothes, so why not your Easter eggs?
Yeah.
Right? They used onion skins. You know, red and yellow onion skins make beautifully dyed eggs. And you wrapped the egg with the vegetable, the onion skins in particular, and then you can tie them up with silk thread or you'd put them in a little piece of pantyhose and put them in a boiling water bath. And so you were cooking them and dyeing them at the same time. And then, of course, back then, we didn't have Pinterest. We didn't have Michaels. We didn't have Hobby Lobby. We had crepe paper.
Yes.
Everything was made out of crepe paper. And if you've been a kid and you stick things in your mouth, you'll know that that also gives you a really colorful fingers and tongues and lips and things like that.
So and a sour face. And it's really gross.
It was really gross, wasn't it? But, you know, every wedding or baptism or whatever, you know, you always had paper streamers, and if you were really into it, you would put two colors together so they would be twisted and they would, you know, it was a much simpler time, wasn't it?
Well, it was, except you had to be very careful because, as you suggested, if you get that crepe paper wet, it's going to, that dye, that color is going to be wherever that crepe paper was.
That's right. So think about that. Good dyeing Easter eggs in the natural way, except I don't know that you could get crepe paper anymore. And then, of course, people did hide them. Like, there were Germans from Russians that I interviewed, and they talked about how their dads would take their Easter eggs outside hidden in their pockets and leave them by the plows or by, you know, in the weeds. Now, you'd have to have really good weather in order to do that because I just checked the weather before I got in here into the studio and I was like, okay, what's it going to be like on Palm Sunday? Well, it looks like we're in for some more rainy weather. So those eggs would be bleeding all over the lawn by the time they found them. So,
well, you can set the stain, though, can't you? Usually if you put them in, is it
vinegar water? Yep, okay. That works as a mordant. Salt works as a mordant. Or copper pennies sometimes you can do all-natural dyeing, which is a I just love all-natural dyeing.
How does the copper penny work?
Well, see, it depends on what color you're trying to dye. Like if you're dyeing reds, you want to use copper, like copper kettles and copper pennies. And then there's like woad, which is kind of a purple dye, but you used urine to set that.
Oh,
that's
thanks.
A mordant. So I'm sorry, you asked.
Yes, urine. Yeah. If we want to go.
See, that's the egg I'm not going to be looking for.
So, well, okay. We'll talk about that sometime. I love to grow things just particularly for dyes in the summertime. So maybe later on we can talk about that. But in addition to, you know, getting ready for Easter with real eggs, and probably not that many, they also took that sweet dough that you would use for kikla and make little bunny-shaped buns. And sometimes those little bunnies or little chicks that they made had an Easter egg in them that would bake when you baked them in the oven. So they did what they could with what they had. And then, of course, they always celebrated Good Fridays with prunes and noodles.
Why?
Why?
I'm not sure, but I think it's because there's no meat involved in that
okay.
meal.
Prunes and noodles.
Yes. It sounds like that good of a Friday.
Yeah, oh, my gosh, you guys. Let me tell you. Now, homemade.
I've had better Fridays.
Is like a colonoscopy doctor who recommended this?
Now, listen. Now, they never ate prunes for those reasons. They ate them because they're really good. I love prune Coogan. Oh, yeah, you already know that. But, you know, noodles are really easy to make. Egg noodles. And, of course, in the spring, you have chickens that are kind of like gearing up to lay lots of eggs. And so all you need is, you know, flour, a little baking powder, eggs, and a teeny little bit of salt to make noodles. So there was one story that I read where this gal had never been to a German-Russian home ever. And I don't know if this goes beyond Germans from Russia. I don't think so. But you sit down on Good Friday, and there's a bowl of stewed prunes, a bowl of buttered noodles, and a bowl of breadcrumbs. And you can mix and match your meal any way you want.
I am not circling that on my calendar.
Yeah. Oh, my
That's
goodness.
Your Good Friday, not mine.
Oh, but I'm not kidding you. That was really good. See, now, I don't know if that's a little more Catholic than it is Protestant. At our house, we had what was called fruit soup and Fleischkäse, which
sure.
is basically fry bread. And then my mom would make soup with prunes and raisins and canned fruit like pears and peaches and things like that. And you would dunk that fry bread in that sweet soup and eat it. And that was really a treat. I think my mom didn't like to deep fry, and so we didn't get it very often. But, you know, Easter is a very important holiday for those people back then.
Well, let's talk about Easter bread then, because this is something I really do like.
Oh, my gosh. I love Easter bread. So here's what you do to get ready for Easter bread. After Christmas, you go in and look at the sale aisle, and that's where you'd find the dried fruit and the candied cherries that you need to make Easter bread.
So, 'cause they can be expensive.
Oh, my gosh. They have gotten to be really expensive. So I always buy them when they're half price and store them in my freezer. And then this time of year, you got to find yourself some 3-pound coffee cans. And that's your biggest challenge. 'Cause Easter bread is easy, but finding cans to bake it in is not. I do make the loaf kind because it is hard to find a metal coffee can. Please do not use plastic coffee. Please.
Yes.
But traditionally, you know, your dough is made out of milk and shortening and lots of yeast. And it is a nice sweet dough like you'd find underneath your Coogan toppings. But then you mix in candied fruit and chopped blanched almonds and grated lemon peel, and you bake it in either a pan or a coffee can. And, of course, it always has an XV marked on the top, and that is a symbol for Christ is risen. And then you cover that up with some really good lemon frosting that kind of drips down the side, lemon glaze. Mm. And you can color it. Most traditionally, you will find that those Easter breads are colored pink. The frosting is pink or blue or yellow. And the candied cherries that you put in there and the candied citron fruit that you can buy. One of the things I found that if you soak that in water a little bit, it kind of reconstitutes a little bit. And then use that water in place of the water in your recipe. And always, this is something I get asked about at classes all the time. Why do you scald milk? Well, I thought it was because they were always using unpasteurized milk back in the day when these recipes were written. In actuality, your bread won't rise very well if you don't scald your milk, because you're killing off one of the proteins in there that actually the yeast doesn't like. If it says to scald your milk in these sweet dough recipes, you must do that. But let it cool, because heat will also kill that yeast.
Now, that's a delicate process, scalding, or because you don't want to outright boil it?
Yeah, otherwise it's real messy.
Right. That's what I was going to say, is don't turn your back on the scalding milk, because it has a tendency to run over if it starts to boil, which you don't need to boil it. Mm-hmm. You just need to get it hot enough so that the skin forms on the top of it. But, yeah, the other day I'm like, what's that smell? Oh, I didn't. I did. I
every
forgot my milk.
For me.
Oh,
every
my.
Time. I cannot do it.
Oh, I could just cry when that happens. So make yourself some Easter bread this year and celebrate once your 40 days of fasting is over with.
Happy Easter, Sue.
Happy Easter to you, too.
You can find out more at therootsellers.com. Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
What's happening is next.
Next time on The Pulse.
Can I feed her?
Is that okay? Of course.
Okay. That's what you want.
Becoming a mother changes women's lives. It impacts their bodies and their health.
I remember being very tired all the time.
I had knee problems after I had him, feet problems.
We'll explore motherhood and women's health on The Pulse.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public. Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And there is that question we like to ask ourselves every Thursday here on Main Street. What is going on? Director of Radio Bill Thomas joins me for our What's Happening calendar.
Thanks. Hi. Let's start in Williston.
Okay.
Thursday through Saturday at the Old Armory. They're putting on a show. You've seen the movie. You've heard the songs. It's Mamma Mia.
Oh, so catchy.
Yeah, yeah. So, this is all about the songs. And, of course, they got great singers there. So that should be a lot of fun. 7:30 to 9:30, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
All right. Sounds very good. The Dakota Woodturners Symposium is this weekend, the 13th and 14th. This is in Bismarck at the Career Academy. And that is on the campus of Bismarck State College. This is your opportunity to see professional master woodworkers at work. If you've ever seen these beautiful hand-turned bowls and platters, and to just think that it could have possibly been sort of a gnarly or plain-looking tree before, and in the hands of these artists as they're bringing this wood to life. This is April 13th and 14th, again at the Career Academy at BSC. The gallery there is open from 9 to 4 on Saturday and from 9 to noon on Sunday, as you can see some previous creations and then these artists at work.
Yeah, I love it. They're asking all the participants to bring some stuff they've done with them, and they're just going to set it up, an instant gallery. That's a cool idea.
That's a great idea.
In Valley City on Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock, it's free. Valley City State University at Rhodes Science Center. It's the solar system, and then all about stars. This is one of those planetarium-style shows. They're beautiful if you've never been to them, and meditative, kind of. And then they'll point out some current constellations and stars that are in the sky right now, too. So that's 1 o'clock at the Rhodes Science Center, Valley City State University, free.
There's going to be a showing of antique dolls. This is on Sunday the 14th in Bismarck at the former governor's mansion state historic site. This is going to be a display of these vintage dolls, and there's also going to be someone on hand to answer questions about these vintage dolls. I hope that some of these might end up at the upcoming Antiques Roadshow coming to North Dakota June 1st. Maybe we'll see some of those there. I don't know. You can check out this antique doll showing Sunday the 14th in Bismarck at the former governor's mansion, 1-3, and there are some refreshments available, and it's free.
Toreadora, Por L'Amor, or something like that. Carmen.
Are you singing the Cuspidora? Don't yeah, sit on yeah, the
that's
Flora
right. That's,
song?
That's the way they always do it. The Fargo Moorhead Opera is doing Carmen. And I sang the song because Carmen is got the most, of any opera, I think, has the most recognizable songs. You know, the dun, 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 the habanera and all these great tunes. Of course, it's a dramatic, tragic story. They updated it, set it in the Spanish Revolution against Franco. This is Friday and Saturday night, NDSU Festival Concert Hall, and they have professional singers brought in. It's a sumptuous production, and Carmen.
Yeah. My grandpa used to always sing that song, but not properly.
Yes, right.
He would sing it about not spitting on the floor.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. No One Sparrow is Forgotten. This is going to be on a Monday the 15th, tax day, in Minot at Minot State University at Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. This is the concert choir and MSU singers presenting this. This is a music of the Northern Plains. Their hope is this concert sheds a light on injustice that's happening in North Dakota and around the world as we can bring voices to the voiceless. This is Monday at 7:30, and it's free.
And Dr. Ellen Brisch is a professor at Moorhead State University, MSUM, and she's widely known as a great professor and gets great reviews. And she's
maker.
Putting her talents here she's doing an event at Bridgeview Liquors. You know, making wine and beer, it's a biological process. Mm-hmm. So, a PhD in biology can bring a lot to it. It's called Spring Sours Bring May Flowers. Sours referring to sour style beers. And so she's going to do a seminar on that and techniques about creating sour beers. That's at 1 o'clock on Saturday at Bridgeview Liquors.
All right. My pick of the week is tomorrow, Friday the 12th in Dickinson at Dickinson State University's King Pavilion. As classically trained violinist and songwriter and former Tiny Desk Contest winner, Galen Lee, she's from Duluth. She's since traveled all over the country and the world, just taking the music world by storm with her just wonderful voice and style of playing the violin, and she is going to be performing at noon in Dickinson at Dickinson State University. If you haven't seen her, make every effort to get around this blizzard and go and see this show. It's a free show. She's a wonderful performer.
The snow will all be
person.
Melted by then.
Yeah. All right, what's your pick?
Okay, this is just because I love to say the name Broom Ball. This is the 2019 USA Broom Ball National Championships in Fargo. It's free. It's at the Southwest Youth Arena. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and it's the annual tournament. 50 teams representing 13 states, men's, women's, co-rec divisions, USA Broom Ball National Championship.
That's what's happening. Dakota Datebook is next.
Fargo Moorhead Opera's 50th season closes with Bizet's seductive and dramatic opera, Carmen. The naive Don Jose falls for the beautiful cigarette girl, Carmen, but this free-spirited gypsy cannot be tamed. And Carmen grows tired of Don Jose when she meets the glamorous and exciting Torador, Escamillo. This messy love triangle is doomed. Performances are at 7:30, April 12th and 13th at Festival Concert Hall, NDSU. Tickets at fmopera.org or 701-239-4558.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind farms in North and South Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 11th, Remembering Theodore Roosevelt, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. It was early April of 1903 when North Dakota welcomed the second sitting U.S. president to visit the state. The first, Rutherford B. Hayes, famously toured the giant Dalrymple Farm, the first of the famous bonanza farms of the Red River Valley. Theodore Roosevelt, North Dakota's adopted son, was the second, and the two-day trip through Dakota's plains was a homecoming for him. The president's special five-car train carried Secret Service agents, reporters, and aides. Along every stop were eager North Dakotans, anxious to see Teddy. After a stop in Ellendale, the express headed to Edgeley. At each location, T.R. referenced his history with the local land.
I am delighted to get back into North Dakota. It's 23 years ago that I first came to what was then the territory of Dakota, and I am overjoyed to be back with you again. My friends and fellow citizens, I am very glad to see you and be greeted as you have greeted me tonight. I have most naturally a peculiar feeling for your people, and it does me good to see you. You are a great state, a stock-growing state here, but the reasons I like you the most are the men and women. In addition, I am glad to see there are a few children down here, too. You seem to be all right in the quantity of children, and I am glad of that because I think it is a good stock, and I do not want to see it die out.
In Fargo the next morning, he addressed the crowd warmly.
My fellow citizens, I do not feel as I were a stranger, but rather I feel that this were more or less a homecoming. For I know your state so well. I lived on the western reaches of your state on the Little Missouri River. Indeed, I was a humble deputy sheriff. It is such a pleasure to meet you here and to have gotten a glimpse of you. I believe in North Dakota. I believe in your crops. And above all, I believe in your men and women.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
As the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg says he can bridge the divide between progressives and red state voters.
We have got to change the trajectory that we're on so that mine is not the first generation to be worse off economically than my parents was.
But does his political track record live up to the hype? Plus the latest on the arrest of WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, philosopher Jack Russell Weinstein joins us to preview why philosophical discussions about everyday life. On this month's episode, it's called How Does Misinformation Spread? And he talks with guests James Weatherall and Kaylin O'Connor as they explore the social dynamics of alternative facts and discuss why beliefs often depend on who you know. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.